Hello and welcome to episode 300 of the Mark and Me podcast. As always, I'm your host, Mark. We've done it, guys. We're sitting here right now and we've done the big milestone of 300 episodes of Mark and Me. It truly blows my mind. As I'm sat here, I still look back and literally look at all the different names of people I've had on this podcast and feel like it's a dream come true. I pinch myself most days when I look at some of the names, but for me, it's all led up to this moment in time. I can't believe we're at episode 300, but there was always, even when I started this podcast, one guest that I wanted above anybody else. I've never kept that back. I've been very open and very honest and always said how much this band means to me. I truly believe it's the best songwriter that we have on the planet right now. This band changed my life, and I said that to a lot of people on the podcast and asked them about albums that changed their life or live shows that have changed their life. And for me, this band gave me an album. They've given me since many albums and so many live performances that completely changed my whole life. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to announce I ticked that final name off my want list of dream guests on Mark and Me. I'm joined by Simon Neil from the incredible band Biffy Clyro and the awesome and touring right now as we speak Empire State Bastard. It doesn't feel real when I say it out loud. 7 years and 2 days this podcast has been going, and I launched with Kevin Smith, a dream guest. But honestly, I've worked so hard behind the scenes to try and make this happen for the big 300. And at moments, there was times when I thought this might not happen. But as I sit here today, I'm going to bring you an hour and 15 minutes of one of my favorite interviews with by far my favorite guest and truly something that I've never been so proud of. It's amazing and will be coming up in just a couple of minutes' time. But just before I get there, I want to give a big shout out to the sponsor of the podcasts, Richer Sounds and Folio Society. Without those guys, I couldn't do this podcast each and every month, but it means the absolute world that you guys support me, so thank you. Now, I don't want to hold back because this interview, like I said, is one of my favourites that I've ever done. So, here it is. Here's me and Simon Neil talking all things music. So, Simon, after 7 years of launching this podcast, and not that anyone's counting, but after 2,539 days of waiting, I can say, Simon Neil, welcome to the Mark and Me podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure to finally be here. It's been a long 2,000 days for me too, Mark. It's been a long
2,000 days. As you know, this is the big episode 300. I've been in talks with so many people about making this episode happen. There was a short list of sort of Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, Keanu Reeves. But I mean this, and I'll be putting this on all my social media. When I started Mark and Me, my list had 10 names, and number one was you. So I can't express with words right now how much this means to me, but I am so grateful that we've made this happen for the big 300.
Oh, you're very kind, Mark. It was meant to be when we connected, I guess, at the 2000 trees. It was just meant to be, brother. But I have to say, you're very kind saying I come in above Keanu Reeves and Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. And that's definitely the shitty end of the stick. But as long as you like shitty sticks, then you get exactly what you want.
The Shitty Stick podcast featuring Simon and Mark. That's a spin-off in the making already.
Here we are, yeah. We just only talk to people that we don't really want to talk to.
And see if we can really make out that we care when we don't.
Yes, exactly. No, it's a pleasure. Congrats on getting hitting 300. I know that how much focus.
Yes, episode one was Kevin Smith, amazing filmmaker. Fantastic. And I think he's one of the best podcasters out there. Episode 100 was Ed Solomon, the guy that gave us Bill and Ted. Episode 200 was my dad.
Mark himself.
Yeah, that's it. Considering you had like Anthony Hopkins and Mads Mikkelsen and all these people. But then here we are, 300, which seems crazy. But what I've done with every single guest is take it right back to the very start. So with you, I was really intrigued what the first album was that you bought or maybe you were given as a kid. You know, when you were a kid and you had those CDs or tapes that you just fell in love with them and you'd listen to them all day, every day, because they cost you sort of £12. So even if they were crap, you'd love them anyway.
Yeah, it was like 3 weeks pocket money to buy a
Exactly. My paper ran for a month just to buy Load on tape.
cassette. I think I did the same for Reload, and then I should just take it straight back.
I know. Can I keep my receipt?
It was cassettes. Cassettes were a big deal for me. So the first records I remember having an impact on me, the very first one I bought was Now 11. And that was when I was like 9 years old, and I liked it because it had a Bon Jovi song on it. It probably had some Michael Jackson, some Madonna. So in that little era, those Now compilations were so important. They really seemed to encapsulate like what was happening on, in the musical world. But that was very much my first dipping my toe in. So the first real record I bought myself on cassette was I bought Metallica's Black Album in 91 in Cyprus, believe it or not, on holiday. And it was, when I look back at it now, it was totally a bootleg. Like I paid full price for something that was basically a shitty photocopy made by someone in Larnaca in Cyprus, but it changed my life. It changed my life. And then we used to have, like, I don't know if anyone remembers, like an outlet called Our Price, which used to be one of like the main kind of record stores in the UK. So there was an Our Price in air, and every couple of weeks when I would get my pocket money, I would go in and I bought Alice in Chains' Dirt. I
Oh,
bought
wow.
Nirvana Unplugged, Pearl Jam 10. I remember buying Soundgarden, Bad Motorfinger, and Woolworths of all places, which,
Imagine them having those sort of albums now.
I know. And that's the thing. I didn't quite realize how spoiled we were for it. It was, my dream was always to have a record in Woolworths. Sadly, that will never ever happen now, Mark.
Or our price.
Or Our Price, I know. But it really, I spent years from when I was 11 years old, I'm sure like yourself, where every penny I had went on cassettes, went on trying to go and see gigs or buying band t-shirts. And in that era of my life, it was about finding like a like-minded community of people, that were just passionate about music. But, it wasn't like life was dominated by football and everything in that era, and then kind of Britpop became a big thing over here. So for me, it was always about trying to find those kind of more underground bands and kind of more interesting sounds. So
I was
thanks.
exactly the same, and I still remember at primary school having a pencil case, and I'd scratched in it Nirvana Nevermind and done the smiley face. And at 10 years old, I think that's quite cool, but you weren't cool at 10 years old. Everyone was
No.
all about playing football or rugby or listening to, I don't know who it'd be, the big acts, it'd be pop music. But I was the outcast. I had to be like hiding my pencil case, like, I like Nirvana and Guns N' Roses and Pearl Jam and.
Totally. And it was like an outsider type of thing to do. Looking back now, Nirvana were obviously a massively mainstream band, but it's kind of hard to explain how they were hugely massive, but you still felt like an outsider if you were into Nirvana and that kind of stuff. And even Guns N' Roses bands like that, you weren't walking down the town in a Nirvana t-shirt. You felt like you stood alone. And if you saw
Exactly.
someone else with like a similar t-shirt or something, you'd kind of give them a nod and try and kind of make friends. And so it was a really enlightening era of my life, actually, I realized. And I think I've kind of caught the bug of that kind of shared passion that, I feel lucky that all my friends and even meeting yourself, Mark, people that are passionate about what they do. I just think it's so important, and it keeps your motivation going, keeps you kind of hungry for new things.
And live music changed for me because even though I was listening on my Walkman back then, and people are going to be like, what's all this stuff these two grandads are talking about? What's a Walkman or a CD player that you couldn't move? If you did, it sort of
Because it would
skipped.
skip.
But my rich friends all had anti-shock ones that if you moved it, it would be okay. But if I slightly moved it in my bag, I'd be like, oh, for fuck's sake, it's gone to track eight.
Yeah, totally. I know. It was so elusive. In fact, even on some of our earlier Biffy gigs, we had intro tapes that are like intro tape, but we would use a CD and see the amount of shows that the intro CD would skip. Because people would be moving in the venue, and it's like it's so lo-fi, but that was, we were at the mercy of a CD. But that's always why I preferred a cassette. What I loved about those early records that I listened to in cassette was wherever you stopped the record was where you picked up again. So if you
Amazing, yeah.
in the middle of track five, you would start in the middle of track five, and it gave me a sense of like an album being a whole piece of art. And being like a journey that it is the whole thing. Whereas these days, the kind of, it's hard not to dominate an album at the front end. You know, it's just the nature of the way people make records and horrible parlance consume music. You know, it's like, so I still am really attracted to that artistic statement of this is who we are at this time and this time period and this moment in our lives. And in a couple of years, we'll be somewhere else, you know, but you need to wait till you fucking hear that.
It's so fucking true. And there's a lost art now of the concept of an album because of a cassette. Even the CD days, I think with streaming, it's a click of a button. So it's a bit more difficult. You used to have a concept of an album. It would just flow and the tracks would blend into each other. And then sometimes you'd get hidden tracks. I remember Ash 1977. You'd fast forward it for 10 minutes after it finished and find hidden tracks in there.
Was that the puking track? I think
the Sick Party, yeah, where they're all just throwing up everywhere. You don't get that anymore.
The fact that thousands of people, obviously ourselves included, spent ages fast-forwarding to listen to a grown Northern Irishman spew for 3 minutes and just says it all, doesn't it?
But it's mental. Nirvana had it, you know. It's all on in Neutro and all that sort of stuff. And I think there's a lost art now. I think people are just... And it's not a bad thing because it's the way the world is with films, with TV. Everything's short for the attention span. But there isn't that album concept anymore where you can push play, apart from bands like Tool, where you just let it flow all the way through.
Yeah, exactly. And it's testament to a band like Tool that they can still maintain that, you know, in 2023, or well, their last record was a few years ago now. But, you know, it doesn't, that's the thing. I don't want us to sound like moaning old men, because the way that music is, like the fact that you have access to everything all the time is incredible. The amount of new bands I've discovered by being able to immediately, when I've read about them, go and check them out. So, you know, Every positive has a negative and vice versa, you know. But yeah, that's still what I aspire to, is those statements, you know, like an hour, you know, well, 3/4 of an hour or an hour of music, and it's kind of that's how my mind works creatively. You know, I was interested. I'm not sure if you're into your movies as well, Mark. Obviously, you are with all the people. But have you seen that new Harmony Korine movie that he's punting at Venice Festival?
Not yet.
It's called The Aggro Drift, and he started it. I mean, I'm kind of hit or miss in Harmony Korine, but he started this kind of like media company, and they've made this AI-aided movie that's filmed entirely in infrared, and it seems like it could be one of the first kind of modern-day movie that is just meant to wash over you and almost doesn't demand your attention. You know, having just witnessed the genius of Oppenheimer and Barbie in a few weeks ago, which made me fall in love kind of with going to the cinema again and that feeling, it was just peculiar to read about this movie that's actively trying to kind of resist that and actively trying to almost be ignored. And I just thought that was a really interesting perspective, you know.
That's not what I want, a world where we've got stuff made for background viewing.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it does sound, it's like you've got your Spotify playlist over there, you've got your Harmony Korine collection over there. You know, it's like, it's kind of the antithesis of what we are discussing here. But I do, I'm always intrigued by things that are pushed to the limit. You know, I don't think that's the way to go, but I'm always, anyone that pushes their art form to the edge, I'm always intrigued by. But all I've done is read about that movie. So, you know, it might be absolutely horrendous in the execution. Because actually with Harmony Korine, it's easier to admire what he does than to actually enjoy what he does.
Exactly.
I think that's where I'll stay.
One thing that doesn't change with the times is live music. And one thing that bands have heavily relied on, especially after the pandemic, is touring as much as you can. Now, I was really lucky. When I was 11, one of my first ever gigs was Green Day on their Dookie tour. So it's fucking awesome, like mind-blowing. I saw them and Weezer and Cooler Shaker all in like a matter of 2 weeks.
Oh, the Holy Trinity.
That's it. I ticked all three off. I was like, where do I go from here?
That's a high mark to begin. Like, see, just Dookie and Dookie, when they were fine, and that was when they were absolutely untouchable. So
I could not believe that there was three people on stage. And I've said this on the podcast a few times, but Billy Joe Armstrong was singing, playing his guitar. They started, and I think they played When I Come Around, which was the song that everyone was watching on MTV. And I couldn't believe there was any three people on stage. I was like, this is fucking unbelievable. But is your first gig as cool, or are you going to lie and say, well, actually, it was Wigfield, and I can't, it's off one of my Now compilation albums?
Well, I've got my, I'm too honest a person to kind of just talk the bollocks. So the first gig I went to with my family was Status Quo. And they normally did a bunch of Christmas gigs. So I just was happy to go as a 10-year-old because there was guitars. Now, even going to see Status Quo, it did blow me away to see everyone just sharing in the joy of music. You know, I think I'd already picked up a guitar at that point, but it was just this communal thing of everyone knew the songs, and I just felt that there was this magic in the air. So having fallen in love with that show, I then, within 2 months, myself and my friend Martin, who used to drum in a band called Aerogram, who I'm...
amazing band.
Incredible band, hugely underrated. Anyone listening, they're one of the most beautiful and best kind of Scottish kind of rock bands, I guess. It doesn't do them a service by calling them a rock band, but they're just sensational, and they were sensational. But we went to see Metallica on the Black Album.
Oh my God.
I think it was October 91, or maybe it was October 92. And we just walked in. We didn't go with our parents. We got dropped off. So, you know, 11, 12 years old, you know.
Be back here at 10:30, no later.
Exactly. You know, yep. like your whole world changed within that 2 or 3 hours. You know, the main thing I remember is being welcomed by all these big, scary metalheads. You know, walking in there as kids with our black T-shirts on, you know, not feeling a part of it. And just the amount of people that like help you get through, and just that kind of camaraderie really stuck with me. And that's before even Metallica took the stage. And then as soon as they came on, they were touring the Black Album. So I think they started with Enter Sandman and straight into like Sad But
Fucking
True.
Fucking hell.
And it just, you know, and then obviously later on they were doing things like Seek and Destroy. So after the show, I had my Metallica Black Album cassette, and then I went out and got Kill 'Em All and Ride the Lightning and Justice for All and things. But that feeling of the power of the music, the fact that it was a band that weren't really on anyone's radar. You know, this is back in an era where you weren't reading about stuff that you weren't interested in. You know, things, you kind of had to find things, you know, like if you didn't read Kerrang or Metal Hammer or something like that, you didn't know these bands existed. So to see another 10,000 people just having their life changed by Metallica was phenomenal. And then the way life works out, 19 years to the day after that, we played with Metallica in India,
and
I got the chance to tell Lars Ulrich, and we said hello to all the boys, and I said hello to Lars, and I told Lars, it probably wasn't the best thing to say, because it was basically me saying, I saw you guys 2 decades ago when I was a kid, you know, probably made them slightly older than they wanted to be, but I had to tell them, because it literally changed my life. And then just some of those moments in life where things come full circle, it was one of the purest and most poetic parts of my life. And even the fact it was in India just made it doubly psychedelic. So Status Quo was the first gig, and then Metallica was the first one that, if I just want to sound cool, I'll say yeah, the first one.
Yeah, I don't tell people Kula Shaker. I'm always like Green Day.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Kula Shaker were happening for a wee while. They were a good band.
They were good. With Biffy Clyro, obviously you guys launched in 95. One of my claims of fame is that I have The Kids Who Pop Today Will Rock Tomorrow still. I wasn't that arsehole that went on eBay and cashed in.
Did you get it back in the day?
I did. I've been there since day one, mate.
I mean, that's so early, Mark.
I literally was there, dude, and I saw you for £3 supporting Headers for Heroes with 100 Reasons, Million Dead. I saw you down in London at one of the showcases with Headers for Heroes, and it was tiny, dude. I think there was like 40 people. I remember my ticket being £3.
God, the good old days. Imagine that. This band's only worth £1.50.
Exactly. And there's 3 bands on that night. You're a quid.
Brilliant.
Money well spent. But I've been there. And do you know what? I recorded back in uni with my band at the time. Worked with Phil English, who worked on your second album as the assistant for Vertigo Bliss. So it's a fucking, you talk about 360 going around the circle.
Wow, and here we are about 20 odd years later as well. That's mental.
Mental.
I really appreciate, you know, it's amazing, and it blows my mind, because I'm such a creature of looking forward and always kind of looking to the next thing. What are we doing next? To hear that you've kind of been on our journey with us, and we're lucky that a good few people have, but to be there from the very start really means a lot to me, Mark, because, you know, that's a different life for all of us, you know, and the fact that we've still kept a place somewhere in your heart or your soul just means the world to me, because we care deeply about what we do, and I really care very deeply about the songs I write. So when I hear that, you know, we've kind of known each other for 20 years without actually meeting each other, means the world to me. So thank you. Thanks for the support.
It's an absolute pleasure. I told you when I saw you a couple of weeks ago at ArcTangent, seeing you on stage was the 63rd time. So I've seen you 3 times with Empire State Bastard, 59 times with Biffy, and I've seen you once with Marmaduke Duke in Birmingham.
No way, you've done the Duke as well.
I've got the t-shirt, the one that's got like a felt feel on it, which people don't make t-shirts that good anymore.
We were very, very proud of that t-shirt. I hope you've still got it, man.
I've got it. It's in my drawer, ready to not wear anymore because I've got fat.
We're all getting old.
I can't fit in it anymore.
I know the skinny wee chests we had. But listen, I mean, that blows my mind. Because to be honest, if you ask me to recall 59 Biffy gigs, I would probably struggle to recall 59 of them. So the fact that you've been at that many.
Well, what goes really well with
favorite,
this?
You have a favourite, if you mind me asking. I mean, they're obviously
so
all
hard. Great. I mean, one of your first headline slots at Download, and I take I'm saying this with full respect, I felt you had a point to prove. Everyone's like, they're not Iron Maiden, they're not Slayer, what are they doing on the main stage? And you came on and absolutely blew everyone away. And I remember seeing people like, I'm not sticking around for this, and then 3 songs in, they're tapping their foot, and by their end, they're having a beer. And I was like, it sounds weird, but you're like that football team that I've like supported since you in the Conference League, and now I see you in the Champions League, and I'm like, fucking go on, Simon, go on, boys. Like,
oh, we appreciate it, brother.
That was an amazing one, and the Unplugged set was magical. But my favorite time I've ever seen you, I think, was supporting the Foo Fighters with Jimmy Eat World at Milton Keynes. It was just a magical day.
Yeah, that full weekend. I mean, see, that was a really special weekend. I mean, Foos were absolutely flying. They've had such a tough couple of years. Poor Dave and the boys.
Mental.
Just such heartbreak all the time. And so we're thinking about them a lot. But I mean, that was probably 10 years ago now, but I remember it felt like every person that had either played a guitar, had bought a rock record or whatever were at these shows, the entirety of the UK, it was like 100,000 people.
It was unbelievable.
And the lineups were fantastic. You just see Jimmy, you know, us, Foos. There was my memory's like a sieve, but there were so many other great bands in the bill. And we really felt welcome. I think that those gigs stick in my mind because I guess we were still just kind of breaking through a little bit. And it really felt like we were in a field full of friends, you know. And see, when you're supporting a band as iconic as the Foos, it can be really intimidating, and you feel like you're maybe an uninvited guest. But see, like that day, you know, there's a few support shows over the years where we've really felt like, you know, like a home team, and that was one of those. And that was one of the kind of shows where I felt like, I think I really like playing big gigs, you know, because, as you know more than anyone, we spent a long time playing small gigs, and even when we played to a couple of thousand people, they felt like massive gigs for a while. So it took me a good few years to get my ego and my kind of mentality in position to actually really live in the moment and just love playing a big gig. And so I kind of contribute that weekend to my
passion. It's quite magical. Every single person was like just appreciating live music. There was no kind of arrogance. There was no kind of rivalries, where sometimes in music fans at festivals, it's like, oh, fuck Sleep Token and all this. I like this band. Like, it's not, I'm not liking them if I like this band, but everyone was on the same page just to be in a field enjoying music. It was amazing.
Yeah, and that's how it should be. And I think I'm kind of hoping this new year as well, it feels like there's less kind of competition with bands, and, you know,
definitely,
less, I can't listen to them because I listen to this. And again, that's another positive to the way we all kind of listen to music these days, is those kind of barriers, and even going into a record store and going by genre has kind of evaporated. And that is a great thing. The fact that people aren't aware of what music they're kind of listening to as much means that our kind of palette is much more expansive, which I think can only be a good thing going forward.
With the band, and obviously after Black and Sky, Vertigo, Bliss, Infinity Land, then you signed that first major label for Puzzle. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds crazy, but it must be really hard because I'm talking to you, not about you, but being involved in the band, I would be buying Kerrang and Enemy to find out the gigs. It wasn't you'd go on Facebook and Instagram and all this. And your tours were fucking insane. Like, most bands had 3 or 4 dates, you had 30, and you were the biggest, busiest touring band I'd seen. Like, that's why I've seen you so many times. You were gigging all the time, literally 100 dates a year minimum.
Yeah.
Did you have time to stop Some people use this as a kind of an expression when they get married, like you need to take a step back on your wedding day and see what's going on, otherwise you just miss it all. Yeah. Were you able to take a step back and see how much you were growing, how the audiences were getting bigger, the festival lineups? You weren't on the very small stage at Reading, which I saw in 2000. You were now on the next stage, you know.
Yeah, you know what? No, I'm not good at reflecting at any point. It's something that as I'm getting older, I'm trying to reflect so that you can kind of just can enjoy the memories of things as much as look forward to the next. But in that era, we were so full of momentum and piss and vinegar. And, you know, even those first few years, when I look at how many shows we played and we recorded an album a year, I honestly don't know how we did it. You know, I don't think we had a day off for about 6 years, and it was mainly because that was what we loved to do. There was never a need to stop. Like, we loved playing to 20 people in fucking in Coventry.
Yeah,
you know, that we were having a whale of a time. And when I look back, I think being naive helped us a lot. You know, we didn't know anyone else that played in touring bands. We didn't know anyone from Scotland that had ever made a record. So for us, that ignorance was bliss. And as long as we were staying in a bloody travel lodge or on a van to the next gig and someone wanted to hear us play, that was all that mattered. And I think that's why we were able to just keep going, because a lot of bands perhaps, and it's hard not to can envisage where you're going to be in a year or 2 years. And a lot of bands maybe are motivated by the thought of success. Because our expectations were so low, our idea of success was being on a tour, was being able to play 30 shows in 30 days. You know, that to us was like, fuck, this is a miracle. You know, so no, and that's a long way to say no. And there was no point where we kind of took a step back and kind of thought, wow, we've done a lot. And I think that's what kind of kept the progression going. It's what kept my juices flowing as well. At no point did I not have another album's worth of music to record. And I think if we'd stopped or slowed down, maybe that would have changed. You know, I think all the energy put into that Biffy Pot over that first few years really just led to so much cool stuff. And I felt we were evolving as a band. Each record, especially the first 3, 4, 5, felt like a real step from album to album. So it blows my mind how much we evolved and progressed in such a short period. But I think part of that was because we didn't take stock.
Did you have any dreams or targets as a band in your head? Like, being a fan of bands like Guns N' Roses and Nirvana, were you like, I need to play Reading main stage, I have to play Download Festival, one day the dream would be to have an MTV Unplugged set of my own? Like, or was that just so far away from any of your dreams that it was just not reality?
I mean, like, MTV and that was so far away. I mean, we never thought we'd be in MTV or Radio 1 or anything. It was honestly like pie in the sky. My main dream was to release a record this now sounds antiquated, that you could go and buy in the shops.
Yeah.
All I wanted was to know that an album that we'd made, that I'd written, was sat side by side with professional bands. You know, that was the maximum of our kind of dream. And then each time we would put out an album, maybe our like ambitions would grow ever so slightly, but always incrementally, and never, maybe this is the Scottishness in us, but we never thought, you know, like miles ahead. We never let ego get in the road. We always thought, well, you know, if we could play in the main stage at Reading, you know, suddenly that became, well, we might be able to play the main stage at Reading. And then you suddenly got on at midday and you're like, wow, we played the main stage. And then you're like, well, could we maybe play later next time? You know, and we were lucky that things kept moving forward enough that we never asked questions. I think maybe if we'd done the lunchtime slot at Reading, you know, 7 times in a row, maybe we would have started thinking, well, wait, what's going on here? But we never had to think about it. We just kept kind of rolling, and we were fortunate that we kept rolling upwards. And, you know, and luck has a lot to do with it, Mark. There's so many incredible bands. And I know, obviously, if you were coming to see Biffy Lots back in the day, you've seen a lot of incredible bands that should have and could have been massive. And there's a lot of luck out there. You know, there's a lot of talented people that work hard. Sadly, that's not always enough. You need a little slice of luck timing-wise, or getting to play with the right band, support the right band. And but I am, when I look at that, it's like that was when we got our work ethic. That's when we really discovered who we were as people and why we wanted to do this. And I think we've never let the idea of success in inverted commas infiltrate our motivation. You know, it's nice when we get to play these, you know, headline festivals and things these days, but it's all about the reason that we get together to make music should never change. And that's been possible because of that first 5 years. You know, we didn't let ourselves get blinded by the lights or get attracted by, you know, hey, you need to come and live in London. You know, like now that you guys are doing well, you need to come live in London. It's like, why? You know,
we're quite happy as we are.
Yeah, you know, no one gave a fuck about us 2 years ago. So why do we need to go to London now when people give a fuck, you know? And I'm glad we stuck with that because it's always been about the shows and the music and just never always seeing the band and the songs as bigger than us as individuals. And I think that's why we've always kept the dynamic and the kind of and the vibe of the band healthy.
I want to move on to Empire State Bassa, but just before I do, what's it like as the man in charge to write a set list for a Biffy gig? Because it must be fucking impossible to please everyone, because you see all the early fans that are like, play Just Boy, play 57. You've got people that want to hear stuff from Infinity Land, which rarely gets played now. But at the same time, a lot of people want to hear the hits they've heard on the radio that help them discover Biffy Clyro. But as musicians and bands playing every single day, nearly all year, you probably want to play new stuff as well to keep you guys motivated and excited. So how do you keep everyone happy?
It's a fucking nightmare.
Have you got spreadsheets everywhere? And see, how many times have we played this song now?
Before we go into it, I must do about 24 drafts of a set list. And some days I'm feeling really ballsy and I'm like, we'll only play one song, one big hit song. And we'll do the rest. It'll be tunes we never play. And then the next day I'll be like, let's play all the hit. You know, let's only play songs that were singles. So a lot of it's to do with my headspace, but that's part of the reason that we kind of have a skeleton of a set when we go on tour and don't change it too much through the course of a tour. Because the one thing, because different shows create different atmospheres and vibes. And because our gig is so intense, once we have a set list that I'm happy with and that I feel like has the flow, hits all the emotions that I want the gig to, and also something that we can play without being absolutely on our knees at the end of it, you know. So it's getting that balance. It's also, if we're playing a smaller show, say in America, we play quite small shows, so we can be a bit more kind of esoteric and a bit wonkier. When you're playing like the O2 in London, it feels like our responsibility to fill that venue with sounds, you know, with the biggest of songs.
Yeah, and of course.
A few weird ones, but it's something I take really seriously. And no matter what set list I pick, no one likes it. Everyone's always like, oh, that's a shit set list. You should have done this. So, and I'm talking about people in the band as well. So it's a thankless task, but it is getting really hard these days. I mean, we could play a Springsteen set, you know, not that I think we're anywhere near that. And I don't think we would have 60,000 people there at the end of a four-hour Biffy show. But that would be my dream. I'd love to play it all. You know, like there's so many songs that we don't touch upon that I forget about. You know, like when you mention Infinity Land there's probably half a dozen songs in that are like my favorites to play, like Some Kind of Wizard and God
Rock.
Oh
my God, I love that.
A dream to play Kids from Kibble, you know.
Yeah.
But there's just less and less room in the set. There's kind of songs, you know, in a kind of growing up way, there's songs we have to play. You know, it'd be silly for us to play a headline a festival and not play the songs that everyone knows, you know, because the reality is that's what's made us go up the festival bills is we're lucky to have songs that lots of people know. And that's kind of, I guess, what a headline band becomes, because headline bands aren't better than the other bands. It just so happens that more people know their songs. So that's our responsibility. But it is an art form in itself. I take it as seriously as when we're track listing an album. You know, it really takes me a while, and when it makes sense, it makes sense. So I apologize to everyone when we haven't played the songs they want to hear, and you're welcome to everyone who hears the songs they want to hear.
Incredible. So let's talk Empire State Bassa, because all week I've had "It's Always Someone Else's Fault" in my head all fucking week.
Oh no!
It will not get out of there. But the album is
smashing the record by the end of the week.
Oh, man, the album is genuinely a masterpiece, and it's early days. But how the hell did this start? Because I know you and Mike are best, you know, best buddies. You've had this project talked about probably since COVID, but when did it actually become a reality of let's actually make it happen instead of talking about it?
To be honest, it was the pandemic,
yeah.
Mark. It took Biffy's diary to be absolutely clear. We've wanted to do it for years. We didn't want to ever do it in a flippant way where if we had a month off, we'd go in and make a record and then go back and tour with Biffy. It was something we wanted to be able to devote time and effort and energy to. So sadly, as soon as we knew that all the touring had cancelled at the start of 2020, that was when we said, right, let's portion a part of our calendar out. So I think in November and December of that year, that was when Mike finally sent all the musical ideas over. And then I just went into the studio and just messed around for a couple of months with weird vocals, weird keyboards. And I kind of rearranged a few of the songs, you know, shortened some songs, lengthened a couple. But every idea that Mike was sending me was turning me on. And part of that, I think, was the frustration of not being able to get out and play Biffy's new album. You know, we had the Celebration of Endings that was meant to come out, and it did come out, but we couldn't play it. And I just had all this pent-up energy and anger about the helplessness of the people in charge and how things just... It just seemed like no one was actually helping the people. No one was helping people that couldn't work. You know, no one was helping people that couldn't leave the fucking house. And certainly people in our industry, we were down the bottom of the list. And I know that obviously there's a lot more important, you know, there's a lot more important things in that era than making music. But for our entire raison d'etre to be taken away was really heartbreaking. So I poured that all into Empire State Bastard, and I poured in some of my frustrations about Brexit, about the pandemic. And then just as we were finishing off the record, really, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. And I just felt... and sometimes when I talk about this album, I worry that it comes across as a political album, but really it's a human album. It's just about, it's kind of, let's give humanity a break. Let's give ourselves a break. You know, we've been through a lot.
It's all gloom, isn't it, at the moment, life? It's not like it was even just 10 years ago. You've turned on the news and everything is just depressing and down, and our days are numbered and more people are dying. And it's like, I just want to be able to breathe.
Absolutely. And that's it. You know, me and my wife, Francesca, were having a chat the other night. Remember at the end of news, there used to be always be a funny story about like someone's his thumb with a hammer. It's like those days, you know, like, I mean, that makes me sound like a Luddite or some old fashioned, but everything is so serious these days. And because we have so many channels of information, you know, my mistake during the pandemic was I left the news on for about 12 months. And I just went down in this spiral, you know, and I was watching it expecting to get a breakthrough of some kind of positivity. And if anything, it just wore me down. So then I spent 6 months not looking at the news and only making music. And that was when the myth of the Happily Ever After kind of came together in earnest, and when the Empire State Bastard came together. So, real fluctuating time for us all that we're still coming out of. You know, we were talking just before we started in the podcast, and you're saying your English teacher wife, and my wife used to be an English teacher, and you know, and obviously how much they've sacrificed and they do for their pupils and everything. But even during the pandemic, you know, teachers were expected to just learn, be able to teach 40 kids from a laptop, you know, and like just all these expectations, you know, that were placed in people. And now, rather than things going back to normal and feeling secure, now it's like schools are literally falling down around their ears. You know,
literally,
like,
yeah.
You know, and it's like it's a really hard to know where to turn. But I always have faith that the next generation's there to help fix things. And I know that's not fair. It's not that it shouldn't be the next generation's fault to help fix things that our generation and the generation before us have fucked up. But sadly, that is the nature of the world. That's what tends to happen.
And we can't change it. That is reality.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
It's, you're absolutely
as grim spot. As it is at times, that is reality. They are the next people that need to step up to the job.
They need to step up, and they've got a lot on their plate, and God help them, because of, you know, that's my frustration with Brexit and things. And, you know, there's bands, I see bands and things that are school kids who would maybe have gone a bit of traveling or something like that, or specifically bands. I was focusing bands, and the way we went to Europe, jumped in a van back in the day, and you could get into France or Belgium or Holland or whatever. and play some shows, and it wouldn't bankrupt you. Now you have bands who are selling thousands of records in Europe who are really have a great following, and they can't afford to fucking go because of all the red tape. And it just means that it, as an opportunity, it's removed. It's like, why would anyone bust their balls playing in a band or making music for 6 years to only be able to scrape by getting into Europe to potentially play to a bunch of people? You know,
And
it's
kind of
really.
hope that they will give up their night and come out to see you. Even if you put the gig on for free, it's still a
Yeah.
struggle. And then hopefully you might sell enough vinyls that night to be able to have a Burger King on the way home. Like, fucking hell.
I know I mean, that makes it sound extremely grim, and that's how it is at points. And
But I speak to bands every day. I've had 300 interviews, and half of them aren't as successful or famous as some. And they've literally toured and gone to festivals and lost money, but they just do it because they really hope they can have that break.
yeah, well, even the couple of bands you mentioned earlier, like Hot Milk and
Yep.
Hold an Absence and things, these bands are front cover of Kerrang! They're making great music, and lots of people are excited by them. And they won't have the same opportunities that we had fucking 20 years ago, you know.
Lucas, who's openly said, and he won't mind me telling you this because he said it on the interview, he's gone back to live with his mum and dad so he can afford to go on tour, you know?
Oh, I
That's
mean,
Hold an
a great
Absence this
example.
week, who are number top 40 in the UK. They've got on the front of Kerrang! Their album's great. They've been playing the main stage at the festivals. They're
All the
living with their
festivals.
parents, you know?
I know, and that's because they care and are committed to what they do, but
Of
that's what it
course.
takes these days, and that's not fair, you know. I mean, we did a bit of that actually, to be fair. We those first years of touring, we all lived at home, and you know, but it was for a different reason. You know, that
Of
was because
course.
we were like, right, we're away so much. Now it's more just there's no choice for people, you know,
Yeah.
and that's someone that has to sacrifice a huge part of their life to devote to their passion, and that's hard to maintain. And a testament to those guys for doing that, because that, you know, sadly these days that's what it takes, and it's almost not fair. It's just it's a tough time. I'm always trying to, you know, I need to watch that I don't turn too cynical and pessimistic, because sometimes these days that's where I go down. But there's so much great music being made because of the fucking struggles,
Yeah.
because of how hard it is. And that whole, especially in rock music, that whole kind of careerist attitude, where perhaps late 90s, early noughties, when CDs were 18 quid, you know, average bands could make millions of pounds, you know, and people would try and achieve averageness so that they could become successful. Whereas I believe that in this era, especially in rock music, no one's under any illusions that they're going to become millionaires. So they're doing things because they care about the music, because they believe what they're doing is special, and that's what matters more than anything. It's not because they've got one eye on the charts or the music industry, because rock music especially, we're standing together, but we're kind of standing alone these days, which is why we need to support each other and get out to as many shows as we can, support new bands, and just fucking, you know, I've got to sound like a politician here, but write to your fucking MPs and say, get, you know, stop hindering the things for the next
Exactly.
generation, you know. I mean, it's easy for me to say that. I haven't written to my local MPs, so that's a bit fucking hypocritical for me to say that, but just basically
Everyone else should.
grab them by the collar. Yeah, I might just after this, I will get
Yes.
my pen out after this and stuff. It's been a long while since I've written a fucking letter.
But
I'll
Empire
end
State
up.
Bastard is about this, and it is angst, and it is angry, and it is hatred, and it is not the you know the shiny, nice little beautiful life that everyone thinks. And I kind of see how you came off the back of doing a tour with Biffy Unplugged. Did you have this part of you that missed screaming? Did you miss being angry? Did Mike miss just writing music that didn't need to be verse, chorus, first chorus? Was he just wanting to just make some fucking angry noise?
Yes, to all of that. You know, it was such a, like, the Unplugged tour was one of my favorite tours we've done. You know, we got to play these beautiful kind of opera houses and theaters, so it was special, but it was very grown up, you know. And whenever, it's always been Biffy's way, and I guess my way with Biffy is, whatever we do, I try and kind of have a reaction to that, you know. So whatever record we make, I try and kind of take my brain the exact opposite kind of side and try and kind of work backwards. And that's what this was. After doing, you know, we did the record, we did the show and did the record and then did a tour. So it took probably about 18 months of playing acoustic music. And I swear at the end of that, I was like, I'm never playing a fucking acoustic guitar in my life. You know, obviously now I'm quite happy to pick my acoustic, but I was like, we need to do something really aggro. And that then fed into the myth of the happily ever after.
Yeah.
Some of Celebration was written, but it probably fed into a little bit of that as well. And it most definitely informed Empire State, because Venart especially, you know, he's such an unusual writer. You know, he's technically one of the best guitarists I've ever seen, but he can also write these beautifully kind of mysterious and kind of progressive pop songs. That was not what this needed. You know, Venart has a nice kind of way of explaining it. It's like, see, during that kind of period as well in the pandemic, the thought of writing vulnerable music or writing something that was emotionally exposing didn't appeal to us. It's like we almost needed to do something that gave us fortitude, that gave us like a fucking spine of steel. Because I think if we started going down the heartbreak route, you know, and quite often that's how a Biffy record will start for me. I'll just write a song that I'm like, right, this is the heart and soul of the record, and then the rest kind of grows. This couldn't grow from a heart or a soul point of view. It needed to remain entirely kind of mental and entirely kind of like an intellectual deduction situation, if you know what I mean, for want of a better phrase. But it didn't have the mystery and romance that Biffy had. So that was it's been really good, and I'm still enjoying being in that headspace with the shows we're playing. It's going to feed back into the Biffy record probably in the opposite way, and then the next Biffy album will probably be full of heart and joy and soul and, you know, and
optimism. But isn't that nice that you get both avenues, and the fact that you can have that when... What I loved about Empire State Bastard was I saw your download set, and then I saw you at 2000 Trees, but I kind of, it was like going to watch a film and not see the trailer. I had no idea what to expect. And that was great, because you hadn't put loads of trailers or TV spots out like you would for a film, and no one knew what to expect. So I was like, are they going to sound like Biffy? Are they going to sound like Oceanside? Are they going to sound like Slayer? I didn't know. And I you only gave one song out at that point. It's the complete opposite of what most bands would do.
And it was terrifying. It was really terrifying.
I was putting myself in your mindset thinking, is this like pushing reset for him? Is he like trying to win a crowd over again? Is he trying to start from scratch? So the moment you came on stage, and you sounded like Slayer, Sabbath, Will Haven, Tool. Brilliant. It was fucking chaos and noise. I was like, this is everything that Biffy isn't at this moment. It's him saying, I'm making a conscious choice not to be Biffy. I don't want to sound like Biffy. I want to just create something different. And do you know what? It won, and didn't it? It's what happened.
Thank you so much, Mark. Your words mean a lot to me, brother. Thank you. Almost everything you said there is true. There's an excitement to not knowing whether anyone's going to give a shit, you know, and I feel very blessed that people care about Biffy. But it means that whatever we do, you know, it's like I need to make sure it's the best thing it can possibly be. And, and it's a real... It's kind of a proper labor of love. This was curious because we weren't going out to try and make friends. You know, after 20 years of playing live, more than 20 years of touring, see to step on a stage and know that almost everyone in the crowd has only heard one song, that was a head fuck. But it was just the right type of head fuck, because I ended up walking on stage carrying myself differently. There was a different purpose. You know, I deliberately didn't want to play guitar in this because I didn't want it to feel at all like Biffy. When we were working on the record and working on the show, it was so important that I really didn't want anyone at any point to be able to say, oh, that bit could be in a Biffy gig. You know, there's maybe the odd moment that could potentially, but the overriding impression was to be, this is nothing to do with Biffy, because you know, there's no point in just expressing a slightly different version. You know, I feel very lucky in Biffy that we can do 7-minute songs that are progressive and heavy. We can do a 2-minute pop song that sounds like fucking Justin Bieber. You know, like that's what I like, that freedom with Biffy. But we would never do something quite as extreme as this. I mean, mainly because I can't write riffs like Venart can. Venart's technique and the way he learned guitar, you know, being raised with Maiden and Sabbath, and you know, he learned a different way. I learned with Nirvana, and my guitar playing came from
very power chord driven, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's that kind of emotion. I'm more about like how I play a chord is more important than what I'm playing.
Yeah,
which is I've got terrible technique. I just bash with my right hand.
It works.
Well, thank you, thank you. No one's noticed yet, Mark. That's what it is. No one's noticed. But Venart's all technique. So he's this real kind of dexterity and precision that I don't have. So it was really obvious that they weren't going to live in the same kind of field. And but yeah, weird to feel new. Weird to feel like we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I love playing with Biffy so much. It gives me life. But we've played enough shows now to know, we know if a show is going to be a good show or if it feels right, you know.
What a switch mentally. Like, you now know that if you put a Biffy gig on, it will sell out. Everyone will sing along to every word of Mountains and Many of Honor and all these songs. You know, they're absolute anthems. They're made to fill a stadium. You go to Arctangent Festival, which is half the bands on there you can't even pronounce the names of. You know, I did interviews all weekend at that festival, and most of them, reality is, they were all saying, like, what are you up to next week? Well, we're back at our jobs at Subway or Spa or this. You know, it's the world is all these underground bands that are all fucking amazing. You'll discover some of your favorite bands that weekend. But the expectation of you to go on stage with two or three songs out at that point, it must feel like, oh, fuck, I can't just pull out Machines. I can't pull out an acoustic and hope everyone sings along. It's literally, are they going to like The Looming? Are they going to like this? Are they going to like that? You know?
I know. It's so funny. You're right. Because normally you can feel it. Well, you've always got a couple of aces up.
Yeah,
there ain't no aces, you know.
No.
Again, I think that's the liberating part. The fact we don't have loads and loads of songs, you know, we've got the first album and we're playing a couple of songs that will end up being in the second album. But, you know, I think that's enough at the moment to define the band. You know, I think if we had more, like, because the first few shows we played, we didn't know what we were as much as the crowd. You know, like, we knew the songs. We'd spent a week together and played, you know, and got to know each other. But after being in Biffy, where I know Ben and James inside out, I know their inside leg, you know.
Yeah.
It was really peculiar. So it took a few shows to really reveal to us what it is. And now I'm kind of, because being this screamer in ESB is so different from Biffy as well, I'm dressing differently, I'm approaching the gig differently. It's a different part of my being I need to, you know, kind of channel or kind of access. And it's strange because with Biffy, I'm always one step away from either crying tears of joy or tears of sadness. You know, like the Biffy gigs are so emotionally heavy for me. They really are. And it's because we're so lucky with the people that come to the shows. The people that care about Biffy really care, and that affects me in good ways and bad ways, because if I feel like I've done a shit gig, then I feel like I've let everyone down, and that can be really hard. But this is about, I'm going out there and I'm not there to make friends. I'm not there to kind of get anyone on board. It's like, this is like a reflection of rage, a reflection of this time in our lives, and it very much is, it could only kind of exist now. You know, even if we had made this record 5 years ago or 6 years ago, it wouldn't be what it is now. We wouldn't have the kind of, you know, I'm going to sound like a dick here, the wisdom.
No, but it's true. It's, you know, all the experience. You haven't lived those years to then be able to tell this story now.
Exactly. And you know what? I thought I was angry when I was younger. You know, and I always hear that some people are angrier in their 20s than they are when they're older. And I do think in your 20s, you should feel that the world's been waiting for you, that you've figured it out, that everyone else doesn't know what the fucking world is. You know, that's important, that arrogance in your 20s. But I feel angrier now about things than I did in my 20s. And it's maybe because I'm looking at things in a different way, and it's a genuine kind of disbelief at certain things that go on in the world. So I feel that my rage on this is really, it's vehement, you know, and as opposed to just perhaps it would have been slightly more performative at points, you know.
Hey, when I was 20, I was angry about everything in the whole world, not earning enough money, my mate having the better girlfriend, all this. Now I'm 41. The things I'm angry about, I'm way more angry. There's less things, but the things I'm angry about are just, I'm pure rage, because they matter more. They're actually important things. And the things that don't matter, I've let go of, and it's a lot easier.
Well, that's maturing for us all, isn't it, really, when you put it like that? I mean, it's obvious, but that's a beautiful way to put it. It's angrier about less things, but the things that we are angry about are really, we have a proper reason to really kind of cut the bone, isn't it?
And it's a very different way to be, but turning it on, it's kind of, I'm not, I suppose changing it back to Biffy, are you going to be hard to let go now and not take that? Are you going to be able to switch it back over and put the different mask on for that? Because you've been so incorporated in this now. You went to Yorkshire, you spent time with different people, you've got Dave Lombardo on board. It's a whole mental, complete opposite side. How is it going to be that you can just then go, right, let's be happy again, pick up the acoustic, or
I'm
let's
write some... Death growling God and Satan in the next fucking tour, man.
Exactly. Everyone's going to be like, we're going to get the early stuff again.
To be honest, it will be tough. You know, that's why I deliberately didn't want Biffy to do any shows this year, because I cannot kind of cross-pollinate my brain. No. I don't want to do a disservice to Biffy, and I don't want to do a disservice
to... They're too opposite as well. There's not like you can blend them. It's not like you can slowly incorporate one into the other. It's yin and yang.
It is. It's yin and yang, and I appreciate you noticing that, because my management don't. You could probably do ESB one day and then Biffy the next. I'm like, no fucking way. Tash will be laughing there. Sorry, Tash. I think what I need to do, and I know I've already got the plan. I've got like about a dozen to 20 Biffy ideas that are floating around my mind. So what we'll do is we'll go into, we're finishing, we're doing a few shows in the US with
ESP. I'm coming to see you in November in Birmingham.
Brilliant, brother. I look forward to it.
I'll bring the wife who's never seen you, so that'll be a good eye-opener for
her. Oh, God. You're going to bring her to ESB first?
Why not?
She'll never forgive you, man. You'll be stuck in your podcast lodge forever. Never allowed in the house.
She'll go fucking mental. She's listened to Biffy in the car and stuff, and she'll be like, okay, I know, but it's a bit like this, but it's the same singer.
Play the Unplugged on the way over, just to freak her right. I go, yes, honestly, it's this vibe. You'll love it. What we do is I'll get back with Ben and James, and we'll get in the room, and I need to play guitar and play these songs for a couple of months to just let my brain connect. I'm like a transformer on Valium.
Yeah.
It just takes me really a long time to change back into Biffy shape. But you know what? Biffy's always in my mind. You know, again, that's part of the reason that I didn't play guitar in ESB is if ever I have a guitar idea, I'm like, I record it and I put it to the side for Biffy, and I'm like, I can't wait to come back to that. If I was juggling guitar ideas for ESB as well, I wouldn't know at this moment what the idea was for. Because if I scream over it, it's going to sound like ESB. And if I sing,
feel like you'd be like, you feel like you're cheating on Biffy Clyro a little bit.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. That's the perfect way to put it. And I'm not up for cheating. I've spent a long time getting this relationship just where I want it to be. Biffy loves me, Mark. Biffy loves me.
Exactly. Empire State Bass is a nice little thing to have now and then, but it's all about the balance.
It is. And to be honest, nothing could ever compete with Biffy. Biffy is my entire DNA. I've poured every important life milestone, good and bad, into Biffy songs, which is why sometimes shows can be tough for me, and sometimes, you know, and why I guess the songs connect with people in the right way, because some of the songs can be tough to sing and some songs can be pure exuberance. But that's really ingrained in my identity, Biffy. You know, I think ESB is something that I need to tap into now, you know, and it won't be a one album project. You know, I love the way Mike makes music. He comes at it from a different angle than I do. So I feel like I'm inspiring and cultivating a part of my brain that was dormant anyway. So I feel that there's no kind of cross-pollination with Biffy. The part of my brain I use for Biffy is entirely untouched and kind of cherished and pristine.
With the lineup though, and having like Dave Lombardo, which must still feel like you're pinching your arm every day, thinking, fucking hell, like you want the best drummer in the world, you've got it. The live show's working so well. Mike being just an absolute legend writing riffs. The fact you said there's more music, do you feel like maybe towards the end of the year, get another album's worth of music together and then wrap it all up to go back to Biffy? Or do you feel like you'll go to Biffy and then come back to ESP?
Well, we're going to be working on a new ESB record in October. We're going to start in earnest.
Wow, that's, you're not going to have any time to sleep.
Oh, I know. I mean, but see, when things feel good, Mark, you know what it's
Why
like?
Why not? Yeah.
See, with work, you know, because you're telling me how many interviews and stuff you've done at the festivals. But see, when it's something you love doing, you know.
It's never work, is it? It's never work if you enjoy it.
Enjoy what you do, you'll never work
a day. But it's true. It's so fucking true.
You know, it's such a
This isn't work today. This is my fucking dream, you know?
I feel exactly the same, brother, and we're lucky to do this. So I never see it as work, but you know, it's about when you're inspired, when the juices are flowing. Myself, Mike, Dave fucking Lombardo, which I was watching Venart did an Instagram live with Lombardo the other day, and honestly, when I'm one step away and I watch Mike talking to Lombardo the whole time, I'm going, oh my God, that's Dave Lombardo. even now. But we've got such a good rapport with the band, with Naomi, with Dave, with Mike and I. We're really getting on great. We're loving playing the shows. The music is flowing. You know, the first album was basically mostly myself and Mike. Dave came in a little later and put all his genius percussion and drum mania on it.
Phenomenal.
And so we'd like to have Naomi in earlier in this album as well. So I'm not trying to make too many definitive plans, but my mind is already on starting the next Biffy album and continuing this. But the one thing is, once I dive back into Biffy in earnest, I know it's going to be a couple of years before we would potentially be back to ESB, because Biffy is...
It's a beast, isn't it?
It's a beast, and realistically we'll be touring for a year after an album, and it takes everything out of me. You know, whenever we make a Biffy record, at the end of it, I almost feel like I've got nothing left to give. You know, I always worry that it's the last album, because I feel like I've used up all my ideas and really given every ounce of energy. And then before I know it, you know, maybe a few months after that album's out, I start getting ideas and concepts.
The itch comes back.
Yeah, exactly. And I've learned not to question it. You know, I've learned before I would feel guilty if I didn't, like, if I had a day basically twiddling my thumbs doing something that wasn't music based, I would feel guilty. And now I've realized that actually, see, taking a few days off actually sometimes helps to then feel re-inspired rather than just that constant chipping away at the mountain. You know, sometimes you need to take a break, and then when you come back, you can see a different shape and things.
Well, then you realize what you missed as well.
Exactly. And that's been a big part with Biffy. You know what I miss, Mark? I miss a really luxurious backstage.
I saw it at Arctangent and 2000 Trees, and I was like, he's got one port-a-loo. There's five little huts. He's got Hellas for Heroes next door.
And that was a delight to see.
That was amazing. I love those boys. And I was just like, this isn't Paris or Wembley.
I know. I spent three gigs sat on the floor for 3 hours before the show. You know, and I'm like, wait a minute. Normally I've got a room to myself and some catering and things. But I mean, I do miss that, but it's so fucking worth it. But there are little things going back to Biffy, just knowing that whatever we do with Biffy, you know, it's like, I'm just so excited. I want it to be full of purpose again, you know.
And yeah.
I think doing Empire State Bastard has taken the kind of the worry off the top of making a Biffy record as well. It reminds you of just the purity of music. And that's between Biffy albums. That's why I always need to reset myself and not think about bloody... Because by the time an album's out, you're thinking about chart positions, you're thinking about tours, you're thinking about things that actually aren't related to the music. So once you've finished a campaign or a tour for an album, I'm always like, right, back to just the purest essence of being that kid with that Metallica tape or that Nirvana tape. You know, are you going to see Dookie? It's like, you know, I'm going to see a band tonight. I'm going to see a band called Full of Hell in Glasgow. And it's really, I just love going to shows and being like, I don't know what to expect. I don't know what I'm going to see tonight. I'm hoping my life will be changed. It might not, but it's still the most important thing in my life. And that's the day I'll stop making music. See, if I don't feel like I have to make music, I won't bother, because there's enough fucking bands out there. There's enough music. There's enough talented songwriters. You know, we have the entire history of recorded music at access. So I really always want to feel that we have that intense intent and intense purpose, you know.
And do you know what? As a Biffy Clyro fan, the best thing about being a Biffy Clyro fan is you never know what's coming next. And I have bands that I listen to all my life that sound like The Cure. They're The Cure. They're amazing, but they're The Cure. Bands like you and Radiohead evolve. Bands like Thrice evolve. There's something different on each album. You might bring in a string section that you didn't have before, Puzzle. Then you've got an orchestra. Then you've got a choir. Then you've got electronic sounds. Then you've got another guitarist. Then you've got more screaming or more harmonies. Then you do a full fucking orchestra session, and you never know what's coming next. And to see a band evolve like you guys, like Radiohead with Tom York songwriting, like Thrice that I think keep evolving,
that's
the bands that will stay with me forever. And that's why I've been to see you over 60 times. That's why I'll probably go another 60 times, is because you never play it safe. You always evolve, all three of you, all four of you with Mike on guitar as well. Like, you fucking kill it every time, and it's it's the excitement of like a nervous excitement, like what's he going to do next? Like, what is this band going to do next? Like, is it going to be poppier? Is it going to be heavier? Is it going to be fucking way out? Is there going to be a 10-minute song or a 2-minute song? And that's fucking exciting, man.
You know, that's just excited me to fucking get started working the next Biffy album right fucking now, man.
You quit ESP tonight now. And I'm like, oh, yeah, shit, that didn't go to plan.
It's over, man. You better tell Vaynar.
Yeah, sorry, Tash.
I really appreciate you saying that. And that's why I feel really lucky with the connection we have with people like yourself who've been supportive of us for so long, because we try and do something different every time. We don't want to make, you know, I'm like you, there's some bands I love who make the same record all the time, and that's fantastic. I've never wanted us to be that band. And
no.
I'm sure sometimes, you know, some of the people like yourself that have been with us a long time, I'm sure sometimes I wrote a song or something will come out and you'll go, oh, I don't like this one. But the fact is, you don't know what we're fucking going to do next. So, it's worth staying on this journey with us. And that's why I'm on the journey. I don't even know exactly where this next album is going to go. I know where my ideas are taking me. But some people might presume it's going to be really heavy because of ESB. And I can't guarantee it's going to. As I said earlier, it's probably going to be
complete opposite.
Joy-filled, you know, not pop, as pop as Biffy get, you know, still a bit wonky, you know.
Is this going to be your Pet Sounds?
Oh, Christ. I've been trying to make a Pet Sounds for a long time. Sadly, the only Pet Sounds I make are fucking just trying to talk
the ones you have to close the door for just before we started. Yeah,
exactly. But you know what? That's my entirety. I would love to make, you know, and I sound like a dickhead here, and it's such a cliche, Kiddie by Radiohead changed my life. Pet Sounds changed my life. You know, there's these albums that you just think, how did someone make that record and know that that was the record to make as well, you know?
I know. Tom York with Everything in the Right Place, those opening like chords. Oh. I don't know how you do that after...
The Bends.
It wasn't those, they did... what's the album they did in between? Okay, Computer.
Oh, Okay, Computer, sorry. Yeah,
How do you top that? And it's like, we're just going to fucking completely blow everyone's mind. You're going to hate us, but then eventually you'll realise it's a masterpiece.
Yes, exactly. And it's having that faith and trust in your own belief, you know, because the one thing about being creative and writing songs is the only thing you can actually judge and the only thing that will keep you right is your own fucking opinion.
Yeah.
When I was mentioning earlier about getting caught up on things like, you know, reviews or chart positions, that's when things become cloudy. It's all about your own fucking instinct. And that's what ESB was as well. You know, we didn't know for sure it was going to become an active band. It was only when Lombardo got back in touch and said, this is fucking brilliant. Let's make a record. Let's record it. You know, up until that point, it was just me and Mike were like, we love this and that's enough, you know.
I love and Lombardo was like, yeah, okay. Like Lombardo.
I know, honestly. It was that weird for us. We were like, shit, we better start taking this seriously.
Yeah, but, like, oh God.
But it's yes. Keeping the excitement, keep that, you know, as I say, I always go back to how I felt as a teenager listening to music. It's like, I want to feel like a whole world's about to open up to me. That can be hard when we've made like 13 or 14 albums, but I take that challenge very seriously, and we don't start working a record until I feel we've found our way through that keyhole and there's something new to inspire us through that door.
And you know what, to nicely end this interview, I listened to your chat with James on Rock Sound, and mm-hmm. you were talking about Lombardo and how it came about, and you sent this email and 24 hours later you got a reply, and you made a really good point about saying that you've got to just ask the question, like, why not? Like, all they can do is say no. And this sounds cheesy, but an hour before I came on this interview, I was kind of walking around the house. I don't make loads of notes. I just thought, this is the one interview I know the ins and outs of Simon and Biffy more than ever.
Appreciate
it. I said to my wife, I said, I took that exact approach when I saw you. You were there in the flesh. I walked over. You were with Headers for Heroes. You were backstage just relaxing before you've set. And I thought to myself, what's the worst that can happen? He can say to me, go fuck yourself, go away, no, I'm not interested, or get this stalker away from me. or he might just say yes. And you know what? Like, it's always worth just taking that risk or asking the question or just thinking to yourself, just ask the one question you want to ask, because here we are today.
Well, I'm so glad you did, Mark. I feel better for having met you, brother. You know, I really appreciate the support you've shown the band, but as you said, you know, life's too fucking short. We're all here for a very short time. And yet anyone listening, that's what I guess we can both a bit of wisdom to impart to your listeners for both of us is just fucking ask somebody, you know, like if you think it, ask it. And then yep. if it doesn't work out, then there's no harm, you know, but you never know, things could fucking just fall in our, maybe optimism's the way forward, Mark, maybe optimism.
That's how Mads Mikkelsen came on here. That's how Anthony Hopkins has only ever done one podcast in the world, because I was the person that just thought, I'm just going to fucking ask him.
Well, thank goodness you did. And yeah. that's a hell of a compliment from Mr. Anthony Hopkins as well, isn't it?
I know. I only got 20 minutes with him, but my God, he's only ever done one podcast in the world and it's mine. So that's pretty special.
Get that in a t-shirt, brother. You need to get that in a t-shirt. Start selling some merch, man. I'm going into overdrive here. I can see it already.
You can be the manager and take 10%. My final question for you today, and everyone's been asked this question that's been on the podcast, is you get to choose the last piece of music that's played. So as this is edited and goes out there for the world to listen to, any song by any band in the whole of music history can be chosen. Now, I've had people come on and pick Nirvana, Rolling Stones. Someone picked a 22-minute Yoko Ono B-side, which I thought was fucking brave, but I still went with it.
Who was that? Who stitched you up with that? Come on.
Do you know what? I'll message you, because I'm not going to say it live on here, or I'll tell you later.
No harm, no
but yeah, someone picked their own song. So Burt McCracken from The Used picked his own song. And I was like, that's fucking cool. Like, if you're going to promote yourself, why not do it in style?
It's fucking classic.
So why not? But
well, I will not be picking a song for myself.
It's not easy. And I'm sure in your head, you've already got 1,000 songs trying to whittle it down now. But what's the song that comes to your heart and your soul that after today's done, the big 300, me and you, what's the song that plays out that just is you?
But I don't want to be a nepotist, so I wouldn't. I'm tempted to like pick an Ocean Size or something, but I won't. I'm going to do something. Oh man, can you give me 10 seconds here?
Dude, everyone pulls out their Spotify, everyone pulls out the phone. I edit it, I chop it out, and it sounds like I say, so Simon, give me your choice. And you go,
and straight away. You know what I'm going to go with? I'm going to actually go with quite surprising Kacey Musgraves.
Oh, I love her. Butterfly, her song is incredible.
That's the fucking one. I was just going to go there.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I can't believe we went with that song.
It is. It's from the album Golden Hour. I mean, to be honest, I could choose any song off that record, but Butterflies, track 3, is an absolute beauty. And actually, our follow-up album, Starcrossed, it's a bit poppier. It's a really interesting record. The songwriting is beautiful, but the production choice is a bit poppier. Really just class. A lot of those kind of Nashville records just sound like velvet. So this record sounds like experience, talent, and money.
That first album with the blue cover, what's it called, did you say?
Is it same trailer, different park? Was that
the one that Butterflies is on?
Oh, and Golden Hour.
Golden Hour is just, it's the warm album for me. It's just like, it's just beautiful. And the harmonies, the lyrics, the guitar, acoustic sound, the production, it's just incredible. And when I first heard Butterflies and the lyrics, I was like, this is just genuinely a masterpiece. It's one that it's like, this song is just incredible. Bought the album and every song is as good.
It is. And the more you listen, you keep forgetting. Every time you get into just like 7 song or 8 song, you're like, fuck, these are every song's as good to the end. And it's this is the kind of song that makes me fall in love with songwriting, which is what brings me back to the art of the song for Biffy. You know, I do love experimental stuff and out there, but see, when I hear someone can make a song like this, and this album is probably from 2019, maybe even a year before that, I love the fact that you can still write a song that should have been written 50 years ago. It sounds like it should have been there forever, and I love that. And
it's incredible.
A lot of, you know, Kacey Musgraves is one of the reasons that I still love writing songs. So it's a nice warm way to end our warm chat as well. You know, I've
been perfect. I couldn't believe you picked that song. When you said her name, I was like, he's never going to say it. Butterflies, go on. And then you did. I was like, fucking hell.
We're brothers from another mother. We have been kept apart by chance and by...
Exactly. I need to shave a moustache in so people start to click.
You could do that this afternoon. Make no mistake. You just need to get rid of the chops, man, and it's there.
I'm bringing my wife to see your heavy band, and then I'll have a moustache. She's going to be like, I'm not liking this influence that Simon's had on you.
Could be a lonely winter, Mark. Could be a lonely winter.
Dude, there isn't genuinely words I can use to say, and the moment you got that email back felt like the moment you said yes to coming back on Mark and Me, and I can't thank you enough. You know how much I love you guys. I know how much I love your music, your band. I've invested most of my teens in your band, and there are genuinely no words that I can describe. I just can't. I'm lost for words. That's the first time I've been lost, but it means the world to me, dude.
Well, it means the world to me that you've joined us in the journey, Martin. It's just lovely to connect with you after so long, and I hope you'll still be with us in the journey for a good few decades yet, brother.
So there it is, episode 300 with my absolute all-time dream guest, Simon Neil. I actually feel emotional listening back to that, and all that hard work, all those emails, all those times that I've waited, and it all came true for episode 300. And do you know what? I even felt at times to end the podcast after this episode because it was just that important to me and so special. And I don't think it'll ever be topped. But I also know that I could never stop doing what I love this much. So don't worry, I'm going nowhere, and there's going to be at least another 300 episodes coming your way real soon. There are probably no words that I can describe to thank Simon for his time. Also to Tash and Paul, the management who made this happen. I'm so grateful, and I've got this forever. And this episode felt different to anyone that I've ever spoke to before. We connected. The chemistry was there straight away. And it just felt like we shared something so special. And I'm going to be forever in debt with Simon for this. So again, thank you so much. But also thank you to each and every single person that has ever supported Mark and me and has taken the time to listen each and every week. Because I don't take that for granted. And I know there's millions of podcasts out there. Everyone wants your attention. And I know how life can be so busy and so manic. And to achieve millions of downloads at this point is just something that I couldn't even dream of, so thank you so much. And I can't not plug the stuff that I want to on this podcast, because this is going to get listened to by a lot of people. So if you're new to Mark and Me, please dive deep into the previous episodes. There's now 300 episodes available, all free, and there's so many different people from so many different walks of life. So please stick around, and I really thank you for taking the time to listen today. But if you love music or you love writing or film, I really do believe there's a guest for everyone on there. And again, please go on markandme.com and share this on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, because people don't realize this. And even though I get these great names, I'm a one-man team. I don't have a management team. I don't have an accountant. I don't have a media team or marketing team. It's all me. So I work my absolute ass off to get these episodes for you guys at home. And all I ask in return is to share it. And if you're really kind and really generous and can afford it, I do have a Patreon account. Each and every month on there, I give away a badge, I give away prizes, I give you a welcome pack. I also give you exclusive episodes that are called The Lost Tapes, but they're only for people that support me on Patreon that get to hear that little bit extra. So please, if you can, sign up on there and support the podcast, because all the money goes right back into the podcast. There is a dedication I want to end this podcast with today. And this episode goes out to my best friend, Scott Higgins. You are an absolute legend and have had such a rough time recently. I'm not going to go into details, but I want you to know I love you. I remember sitting down once and talking about how much of a dream it would be to have Simon Neil on this podcast. And my friend, we made it happen. We've shared so many times watching Biffy Clyro together and have so many memories because of this band. And I really want to give everything to you. So this is for you, my friend, and I really hope you've enjoyed it as much as me. I'll be back in only a few days' time with another brand new episode. But until then, look after yourself, listen to Empire State Bastard, listen to Biffy Clyro, listen to every episode of Mark and Me ever made, and I'll speak to you all very soon. Lifting me up, instead of holding me down.
what color makes me wonder where you've always been. I was hiding in doubt till you brought me out of my chrysalis. Then I taking